Splendid blessed day and a warm welcome to the Grillet Cafe brought to you by Frontinus Limited. Frontinus is a communications consultancy focused on engineering, infrastructure and sustainability. With you today is Angie Musa, political scientist and teaching associate at the University of Cambridge. And I'm very pleased as always to be accompanied by Mr. Anthony Haynes, creative director of Frontinus. Greetings, Mr. Anthony.
Greetings, Angie.
So our topic for this episode is abstract. But before going any further, would you mind explaining to us, Dr. Anthony, why should we be discussing this topic on this podcast? After all, grey literature is usually defined in contrast to journal and book publishing, yet aren't abstracts considered in a way part of journal publishing?
Okay, well, that's a fair question. And really, I've got two answers to it. The first is abstracts obviously typically accompany journal papers, but you use abstracts for many other things as well. So, for example, for presentations and for conference papers and so on. So they're not just a sort of subset of journal publishing. And the second thing is probably more important is that abstracts usually have to function independently. So if you take the example, let's take an example of an abstract written for a journal paper. The abstract will often be published independently. So you might have the journal paper behind a paywall, but the abstract freely available online. And people will read abstracts and not necessarily read the papers. So the abstracts need to, people need to be able to learn from the abstracts and understand the abstracts independent of the paper. And therefore, although, yes, journal papers would not normally be considered as grey literature, the abstracts can be considered as such.
I think you're being very generous when you said that people will not often, like not always read the papers. I think they will rarely read papers. So, yes. No, I completely agree with abstract as an independent thesis. And in fact, as I said, as like an academic who have written or rather struggled to put together many abstracts over the past decade or more, I personally really appreciate discussing this topic in this episode. Actually seeing how important and profound this topic is, I believe Dr. Anthony opted to discuss the topic of abstracts over two episodes, right? So in the coming episode, we will be discussing the process of writing an abstract. Meanwhile, in this episode, we focus instead on structure and content. On that note, let's proceed with today's discussion right away and allow me, Dr. Anthony, to ask you, what's your approach to structure and content?
Okay, well, I did a study of abstracts to support the training that I provide on writing abstracts. And that study indicated to me three things, really. The first finding was there are seven types of content that an abstract can include. The second one is of those seven, three of them are obligatory. In other words, if you don't have those three types of content, you haven't got an abstract. And then the third finding was obviously the remaining four are optional. They can go in if you wish, but they don't have to.
Well, that's quite an interesting approach. So what is the first type of content, if I may?
The first type is context, a contextual sentence or possibly group of sentences, where you're really trying to give the reader a view of where is this study situated? Where's it coming from? What's the background to this study? What does it grow out of? So the interesting thing about contextual sentences is they don't have to be really original. I mean, there's this endless emphasis in academia on writing things that are novel and original. Actually, a context sentence can be, I would even say, doesn't want to be original. You're really trying to come up with something that is everyone accepts is true, and almost to the extent that it's banal. So let me give you some examples. Yes. You might say, over the last 20 years, research has increasingly focused on some particular topic, right? And the reader, you don't want the reader to argue with that. You want the reader to say something like, yeah, she's right. Yeah, it's true that research has focused on that. Or you want the reader to say something like, yeah, I'm with you there. And so part of this function of the context section is actually to build a bit of a bridge, to build confidence in the reader who think, oh, I'm going to understand this, and to build a bit of shared understanding.
Interesting. Wow. Okay, and then what is the next type of content in that respect.
The second one is the identification of the research problem. And I think this is obligatory. I mean, if you write an abstract and you don't tell people what the research problem is, I don't think it's a good abstract at all. And there are several things to say about this. So it would take a little while to explain. The first thing is, I think you want some negative language around it, because how do our brains sense that we're dealing with a problem, that the thing we're talking about is actually a problem? The answer is we use negative language. So we say things like current theories are unable to explain so-and-so, or current models are unable to handle such and such a scenario, or we lack the data to explain this type of thing. So it's all about what we can't do and what we don't have. And that negative language signals that there's a problem. And what that does is it provides two kinds of motivation. Okay, the first type of motivation, which is the one that people normally talk about, is it motivates the researcher to do the study. Like, we've got a problem and we want to try and solve it, so that's why I'm doing the study. But it also motivates the reader in the sense that most of us, when we're presented with a problem, frown a bit and think, oh dear, that's bad. You know, we're unable to explain this. Oh dear, we haven't got the data for that. Oh dear, that's bad. And so as a reader, you actually kind of want to read on to find out what the solution is. So it motivates the reader as well. When I say use negative language, people sometimes ask me, what's the best word or group phrase to identify a problem with? If you want to show there's a problem here. And believe it or not, the best word to use is the word problem. So you say something like, the problem that this study seeks to solve, right? And actually use the word problem in your abstract. I know it's a very long answer, but I just want to say one more thing about the problem. If it's a research problem, it seems to me it has to be a cognitive problem. I mean, that's to say, it's to do with a lack of knowledge or a lack of understanding. You know, we just don't know something. We don't really understand how something works. Then it's a research problem. Now, I do a lot of work in applied sciences like engineering and biotechnology. And in those contexts, sometimes the authors refer to their research problem as a real life problem. You know, like there's something in engineering that we're trying to do. We're trying to build something in a certain way. And so they give you the practical problem. Well, it's fine to have a practical problem to start with. Of course, in engineering you do that. But that itself is not a research problem. It only becomes a research problem when you identify the lack of knowledge or understanding that's preventing you doing the thing you want to do. So I'd always urge people to express a problem in terms of a lack of knowledge or understanding.
Wow, that's really fascinating, the kind of idea of cognitive problem. Wow, okay. So once we have the cognitive problem, which is quite difficult to find one sometime, what would be the next thing to include into the abstract?
The next one is an optional one, which is to say, what's your research question? And the reason I say it's optional is you have to make a decision whether stating the question actually adds anything. So let me give you an example. I'll take a real world problem, but supposing I said to you, Inge, I've lost my pen. Okay, that's my problem. I've lost my pen. If the question is, where is my pen? That adds nothing to our understanding of the situation. It really just repeats the problem. So there's no point saying it. But I might want to refine it by narrowing down the problem to a more specific question like, where did I last have it? Well, that adds a little bit to our understanding of the situation. So I think you have to make a judgment about, does the question actually enhance the reader's understanding, or is it just redundant?
Okay, interesting. Okay. So, so far, context, problem, and question. Next one, fourth.
Next one's a bit similar to the question, which is the aim of a study. You could use the word goal, but purpose. What's the study designed to do? What are you aiming to achieve through this study? Now, the reason I say it's optional is, again, it might not add anything. to the understanding. So if you say the problem is I've lost my pen, my question is where is my pen, and my aim is to find my pen, this is just saying the same thing over again in different forms. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really add anything. But if it was the problem is I've lost my pen, the question is where did I last have it, and then the aim is to retrace my steps over the day until I get to the point where I realize I last had it, then it's adding something a bit more specific. So again, you just have to make a judgment, like, are you enhancing the reader's understanding or not?
Interesting. Okay. And what would be the fifth then? Hopefully one that's obligatory.
Yeah. So the fifth one you have to have, it's a description of your method. So how did you do things? And I think if you write an abstract and you don't let readers in on how you did the study, then it's not a proper abstract. It doesn't have to be very long. So often the method sentence might be one sentence long, or even half a sentence. You know, it might be saying something like, using semi-structured interviews with 36 mid-level professionals, comma, and then the remainder of the sentence. So if your method is a standard method, often this can be very brief. If you've had to invent a method, devise a method, well, then you're going to say more about it. And if you've had to, if you've used a standard method, but you've had to adapt it or produce some sort of workaround or something like that, well, then you've got to say something about that as well. But if what you're doing is applying a standard method, then in the abstract itself, it shouldn't take very much space, but it has to be there.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. So once we kind of clarify the methods, be it either a standard one or slightly innovative or adaptive one, what would be the sixth component?
The sixth one is the third of the obligatory ones. So along with stating the problem and the method, it's saying, what did you find out? So giving people the results or the findings of your study. And this might sound obvious that you have to include these things, but actually quite a lot of people don't do this. And this is to do with the fact that they're confusing abstracts and introductions. So it may well be that when you're writing a journal paper and you write an introduction, you don't give people the findings, the results in your introduction. You might think, I'll leave that to later. But in an abstract, you do have to include results. People want to learn from the abstract itself something about what you found out. So my rule there is the abstract has to be substantive. In other words, it has to include something of substance about the results. So sometimes you read abstracts where people say results are presented concerning the perceptions of some particular problem, and you think, yeah, okay, results are presented. And what are they then? And they don't tell you in the abstract. And that assumes that you're going to read the paper. That's really not a professional way of writing an abstract. So you want to give people something of the results in your abstract. Now, I don't think writing abstracts, once you've kind of hit upon the kind of protocol I'm presenting here, once you've use that method, I don't think writing abstracts is intellectually actually a very difficult thing to do. But I do think this bit of writing is intellectually difficult to do. The reason is you can't put all your results in, because if you try and put all your results in, you're ending up writing a paper rather than an abstract. So how do you do this? And basically, you've got really two ways of doing it. One is just to be selective and say, maybe you've got 10 different results, but actually one of them is the headline one. One of them is a really interesting one. So maybe you just put in the headline result and never mind the others.
Okay.
The other way of doing it is to characterize the results as a whole and say, you know, overall, the results tend to show that X is a stronger determinant of Y than people realized, without going into the detail. So you can either sort of say, well, let's look at results as a whole and let's just give, you know, perhaps a bit vaguely some sort of broad statement of them. or you just choose the one that you think that's what people are really interested in and just go for the headline result. But either way, what you have to do is give people some substance. So if you find yourself writing something like results are presented concerning and you never tell them what the results are, that's a problem.
Okay, that's fascinating. If I may just stay with this point for a little longer. So I personally, like coming from a humanities background, it's not that I have an issue with results or findings, but it's not very familiar in my field. So we usually like use the main argument. So would you say that for people who don't have like specific findings or results, like as the science people do, or as, for example, some projects we do outside of academia altogether, would that kind of mimic the argument for people who are doing humanities papers, for example?
Well, I'm fascinated in your question. I'll tell you why. If I use the word results, people in humanities often don't, they're not very comfortable with that. So I added the word findings in the hope that it might solve that problem, but it obviously hasn't solved the problem. So the way I would do it is this. I would say what you need to do is answer the question, what did you find out?
Yeah.
Now, whether you want to call that, whatever you want to call that, I don't think it matters. It's one way or another, people want to know what you found out.
Okay.
And so you can think, if you think of the three obligatory ones as the problem, the method, and the what you found out, you get a kind of little story, don't you? You get a mini story, which is, well, what's the problem you're trying to solve? How did you go about that then? And what did you find out? And that seems to me like that's the kernel of the abstract. And if any one of those three is missing, that's a problem.
Interesting. Wow. And then what is the finale one then?
The last one, I'm never sure whether to present this as one thing or two things, actually, but let's present it as one. Mm. It's the implications. So this is an optional one. I should say, incidentally, that word limits for abstracts vary enormously. I think often in natural science, word limits are tighter than they are in humanities. And therefore, these optional ones sometimes get left out, implications and context in particular, because there's just not enough room to put them in. By the implications, what I mean is, okay, you've told us what you found out. So what? What are we supposed to do with this stuff that you've just told us? And really, you can break this into two questions, which is why I wasn't sure if this is one idea or two, really. One question is, how should we think differently? How does your study change the way which we should think? And the second question is, what should we do differently? Like, how should it change our behavior or our practice in some way? And sometimes studies can have both the sort of, I'm not quite sure what to call it, the mental or the cognitive or the intellectual implication, like we should think differently. Sometimes it has that, and it has the practical thing like, well, we should change the way we go about constructing bridges or something of that kind. I think it largely depends on the audience you're writing for. So if you're communicating in to non-academics, I'd probably finish with the sort of, well, what should we do differently? And if I was communicating to abstract academics, I'd probably finish with the question of how should we think differently. But I don't, you know, that's not a kind of fast, firm and fast rule. It's just a suggestion.
Okay, I can't really stop myself, but I have to ask this one. So would you kind of include like what is still missing to be solved? If it's a big problem and you have kind of solved it to the best of your ability, but you think kind of it opened further door for research, would that be included in implications, or do you think that's something different and that will appear in the paper?
That's a good question. So I often do workshops on how to write conclusions, and I tend to suggest that people include that in their conclusions rather than just summarize the paper, that they talk about what, you know, what's missing, and that's part of a broader question of what the limitations of the studies are. There's certainly no rule against including it in the abstract. I think in practice that doesn't happen very much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably to do with word count in the end. But there's just not enough room to go into that. But
it's different from implications in that respect.
Well, it depends what you do with that the fact was missing. So, okay, for instance, when I'm helping students write the conclusion of a dissertation, I will often suggest they do the sort of what did we find out summary of the paper, of the dissertation. Then what are the limitations, including, you know, what's missing? And then I would put the implication after that, like, well, is that a problem that it's missing? In which case, well, we need to do some further work on it, don't we? So further work is required on this. So then it becomes an implication if you then say, well, what do we do to avoid what's missing, to put right what's missing? But I think it's quite difficult to find room to do that in an abstract, unless we're talking about the abstract of a PhD thesis, in which case you do have more room and you might well include those.
Interesting. Okay. So I have one more question to ask. I think you kind of already covered it in a way, but I believe it would be helpful to just like hear it from you again, the idea of sequencing. So to what extent or how much does the sequencing of these different parts matter? I'm seeing that you kind of answered in a bit in the sense of a storytelling, but again, if you may reiterate that for us, that would be great.
Okay, so the way I've presented these seven components is not arbitrary. I've presented them in a certain sequence. And I've done that deliberately because what I find is if you follow the sequence, you will tend to end up with a story almost without trying. It will tend to actually feel like there's a narrative. Whereas often when you read people's abstracts, often you don't get a sense of narrative. Often it's like there's a sentence and then there's another sentence and then there's another sentence. So it's an assemblage of sentences. And it's more satisfying if you can present it in the form of a story. So I find this sequence, it doesn't guarantee that what you come up with will read like a narrative, but it makes the probability of that happening much greater. And particularly though, that kernel of, you know, what problem did you try and solve? How did you go about it? And what did you find out? Seems to me the sequence is very important there. So the sequence isn't sacrosanct, obviously, but it does give you much more opportunity of producing something that has a narrative flow to it.
Interesting. Okay. So just to quickly summarize then, praying that someone, certainly myself, would put to work what was covered today in formatting their coming abstract. So there are seven types of content that may appear in an abstract. So we said that the three that must be included. So we have the research problem, the method, and the results. And the, as you kindly suggested, they could be kind of flow in a flow of story. And then we have the optional one, the context to start with, the question, and then the aim, and lastly, the implications. Okay.
Yeah.
On that note, allow me to kindly thank you so much, Dr. Anthony, for such a very insightful episode, praying that the next episode will be as equally, if not more, beneficial for our respective audience. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Inji. It's been a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you. This was Inji Musa with Anthony Haynes. Greylat Cafe is edited by Dr. Bart Hallmark and produced by Frontinus Limited. Frontinus specializes in grey literature forms such as proposals, publications, papers, and reports. Frontinus helps creators of grey literature to achieve high-quality professional outputs and to be more productive. To discuss your grey literature needs and to see how Frontinus can help, you can contact Frontinus via their website, frontinus.org.uk. There is a link in the show notes. The music is from Handel's Water Music, courtesy of the United States Marine Band and Marine Chamber Orchestra.